he said. They rode to the lake the Dothraki called the Womb of the World, surrounded by a fringe of reeds, its water still and calm. 1,000,000 years ago, Jiqui told her, the first man had emerged from its depths, riding upon the back of the first horse. The procession waited on the grassy shore as Dany stripped and let her soiled clothing fall to the ground. Naked, she stepped gingerly into the water. Iria said the lake had no bottom, but Dany felt soft mud squishing between her toes as she pushed through the tall reeds. The moon floated on the still black waters, shattering and reforming as her ripples washed over it. Goose pimples rose on her pale skin as the coldness crept up her thighs and kissed her lower lips. The stallion's blood had dried on her hands and around her mouth. Dany cupped her fingers and lifted the sacred waters over her head, cleansing herself and the child inside her, while the Carl and the others looked on. She heard the old women of the Dashkaleen muttering to each other as they watched and wondered what they were saying. When she emerged from the lake, shivering and dripping, a handmaid, Doria, hurried to her with a robe of painted sand silk, but Khal Drogo waved her away. He was looking on her swollen breasts and the curve of her belly with approval, and Dany could see the shape of his manhood pressing through his horsehide trousers below the heavy gold medallions of his belt. She went to him and helped him unlace. Then her huge Khal took her by the hips and lifted her into the air as he might lift a child. The bells in his hair rang softly. Dany wrapped her arms around his shoulders and pressed her face against his neck as he thrust himself inside her. Three quick strokes, and it was done.
"The stallion who mounts the world," Drogo whispered hoarsely.
His hands still smelt of horse blood. He bit at her throat hard in the moment of his pleasure, and when he lifted her off, his seed filled her and trickled down the inside of her thighs. Only then was Doria permitted to drape her in the scented sand silk, and Iri to fit soft slippers to her feet. Khal Drogo laced himself up and spoke a command, and horses were brought to the lakeshore. Kahalo had the honor of helping the Khaleesi onto her silver. Drogo spurred his stallion and set off down the God's Way beneath the moon and stars. On her silver, Dany easily kept pace. The silk tenting that roofed Khal Drogo's hall had been rolled up tonight, and the moon followed them inside. Flames leapt 10 feet in the air from the three huge stone-lined fire pits. The air was thick with the smell of roasting meat and curdled fermented mare's milk. The hall was crowded and noisy when they entered, the cushions packed with those whose rank and name were not sufficient to allow them at the ceremony. As Dany rode beneath the arched entry and up the center aisle, every eye was on her. The Dothraki screamed out comments on her belly and her breasts, hailing the life within her. She could not understand all they shouted, but one phrase came clear. "The stallion that mounts the world," she heard, bellowed in 1,000 voices. The sounds of drums and horns swirled up into the night. Half-clothed women spun and danced on the low tables, amidst joints of meat and platters piled high with plums and dates and pomegranates. Many of the men were drunk on clotted mare's milk, yet Dany knew no Arraks would clash tonight. Not here, in the sacred city, where blades and bloodshed were forbidden. Khal Drogo dismounted and took his place on the high bench. Khal Jomo and Khal Ogo, who had been in Vase Dethrak with their Kalasars when they arrived, were given seats of high honour to Drogo's right and left. The blood riders of the three Khals sat below them, and farther down, Khal Jomo's four wives. Dany climbed off her silver and gave the reins to one of the slaves. As Doria and Iri arranged her cushions, she searched for her brother. Even across the length of the crowded hall, Viserys should have been conspicuous, with his pale skin, silvery hair, and beggar's rags, but she did not see him anywhere. Her glance roamed the crowded tables near the walls, where men, whose braids were even shorter than their manhoods, sat on frayed rugs and flat cushions around the low tables, but all the faces she saw had black eyes and copper skin. She spied Sir Jorah Mormont near the centre of the hall, close to the middle fire pit. It was a place of respect, if not high honour. The Dothraki esteemed the knight's prowess with a sword. Dany sent Shiqui to bring him to her table. Mormont came at once and went to one knee before her.
"Khaleesi," he said, "I am yours to command."
She patted the stuffed horsehide cushion beside her. "Sit and talk with me."
"Oh, you honour me?"
The knight seated himself cross-legged on the cushion. A slave knelt before him, offering a wooden platter full of ripe figs. Sir Jorah took one and bit it in half. "Where is my brother?" Dany asked. "He ought to have come by now, for the feast."
I saw his grace this morning," he told her. "He told me he was going to the Western Market in search of wine."
"Wine?" Dany said doubtfully. Viserys could not abide the taste of the fermented mare's milk the Dothraki drank. She knew that. And he was oft at the bazaars these days, drinking with the traders who came in the great caravans from east and west. He seemed to find their company more congenial than hers.
"Wine," Sir Jorah confirmed. "And he has some thought to recruit men for his army from the sellswords who guard the caravans."
A servant girl laid a blood pie in front of him, and he attacked it with both hands. "Is that why?" she asked. "He has no gold to pay soldiers. What if he's betrayed?" Caravan guards were seldom troubled much by thoughts of honour, and the usurper in King's Landing would pay well for her brother's head.
"You ought to have gone with him to keep him safe. You are his sworn sword." "We are in Vaes Dothrak," he reminded her. "No one may carry a blade here, or shed a man's blood."
"Yet men die," she said. "Jogo told me. Some of the traders have eunuchs with them, huge men who strangle thieves with wisps of silk. That way no blood is shed, and the guards are not angered."
"Then let us hope your brother will be wise enough not to steal anything."
Sir Jorah wiped the grease off his mouth with the back of his hand and leaned close over the table.
"He had planned to take your dragon's eggs until I warned him that I'd cut off his hand if he so much as touched them."
For a moment, Dany was so shocked she had no words.
"My eggs? But they're mine. Magister Illyrio gave them to me, a bridal gift. Why would Viserys want... They're only stones."
"The same could be said of rubies and diamonds and fire opals, Princess. And the dragon's eggs are rarer by far. Those traders he's been drinking with would sell their own manhoods for even one of those stones. And with all three, Viserys could buy as many cell swords as he might need."
Dany had not known, had not even suspected. "Then he should have them. He does not need to steal them. He had only to ask. He is my brother, and my true king."
He is your brother," Sir Jorah acknowledged.
"You do not understand, sir," she said. "My mother died giving me birth, and my father and my brother Rhaegar even before that. I would never have known so much as their names if Viserys had not been there to tell me. He was the only one left. The only one. He is all I have."
"Once," said Sir Jorah. "No longer, Khaleesi. You belong to the Dothraki now. In your womb rides a stallion who mounts the world."
He held out his cup, and a slave filled it with fermented mare's milk, sour-smelling and thick with clots. Dany waved her away. Even the smell of it made her feel ill, and she would take no chances of bringing up the horse's heart she had forced herself to eat. "What does it mean?" she asked. "What is this stallion? Everyone was shouting it at me, but I don't understand."
"A stallion is the Carl of Carls, promised in ancient prophecy, child. He will unite the Dothraki into a single Khalasar and ride to the ends of the earth, or so it was promised,
All the people of the world will be his herd.
Oh, Danny said, in a small voice. Her hand smoothed her robe down over the swell of her stomach. I named him Rago.
A name to make the usurper's blood run cold.
Suddenly, Doria was tugging at her elbow. My lady, the handmaid whispered urgently, your brother. Danny looked down the length of the long, roofless hall, and there he was, striding toward her. From the lurch in his step, she could tell at once that Viserys had found his wine, and something that passed for courage. He was wearing his scarlet silks, soiled and travel-stained. His cloak and gloves were black velvet, faded from the sun. His boots were dry and cracked, his silver-blonde hair matted and tangled. A longsword swung from his belt in a leather scabbard. The Dothraki eyed the sword as he passed. Danny heard curses and threats and angry muttering rising all around her like a tide. The music died away in a nervous stammering of drums. A sense of dread closed round her heart. Go to him, she commanded Ser Jorah. Stop him. Bring him here. Tell him he can have the dragon's eggs, if that's what he wants. The knight rose swiftly to his feet.
Where is my sister?
Viserys shouted, his voice thick with wine.
I've come for her feast. How dare you presume to eat without me? No one eats before the king. Where is she? The whore can't hide from the dragon.
He stopped beside the largest of the three fire pits, peering around at the faces of the Dothraki. There were 5,000 men in the hall, but only a handful who knew the common tongue. Yet even if his words were incomprehensible, you had only to look at him to know that he was drunk. Ser Jorah went to him swiftly, whispered something in his ear, and took him by the arm, but Viserys wrenched free.
Keep your hands off me! No one touches the dragon without leave!
Danny glanced anxiously up at the high bench. Khal Drogo was saying something to the other Khals beside him. Khal Jomo grinned, and Khal Ogo began to guffaw loudly. The sound of laughter made Viserys lift his eyes.
Khal Drogo, he said thickly, his voice almost polite. I'm here for the feast.
He staggered away from Ser Jorah, making to join the three Khals on the high bench. Khal Drogo rose, spat out a dozen words in Dothraki, faster than Danny could understand, and pointed.
Khal Drogo says, your place is not on the high bench, Ser Jorah translated for her brother. Khal Drogo says, your place is there.
Viserys glanced where the Khal was pointing. At the back of the long hall, in a corner by the wall, deep in shadow, so better men would not need to look on them, sat the lowest of the low. Raw, unblooded boys, old men with clouded eyes and stiff joints, the dim-witted and the maimed. Far from the meat, and farther from honour.
That is no place for a king, her brother declared.
Is place,
Khal Drogo answered in the common tongue that Danny had taught him.
For sore foot king,
he clapped his hands together.
A cart! Bring cart for Khal Ragat!
5,000 Dothraki began to laugh and shout. Ser Jorah was standing beside Viserys, screaming in his ear, but the roar in the hall was so thunderous that Danny could not hear what he was saying. Her brother shouted back, and the two men grappled, until Mormont knocked Viserys bodily to the floor. Her brother drew his sword. The bared steel shone a fearful red in the glare from the fire pits.
Keep away from me,
Viserys hissed. Ser Jorah backed off a step, and her brother climbed unsteadily to his feet. He waved the sword over his head, the borrowed blade that Magister Illyrio had given him to make him seem more kingly. Dothraki were shrieking at him from all sides, screaming vile curses. Danny gave a wordless cry of terror. She knew what a drawn sword meant here, even if her brother did not.
Her voice made Viserys turn his head, and he saw her for the first time.
There she is,
he said, smiling. He stalked toward her, slashing at the air as if to cut a path through a wall of enemies, though no one tried to bar his way.
The blade. You must not, she begged him. Please, Viserys, it is forbidden. Put down the sword and come share my cushions. There's drink, food. Is it the dragon's eggs you want? You can have them. Only throw away the sword.
Do as she tells you, fool, Sir Jorah shouted, before you get us all killed.
Viserys laughs.
They can't kill us. They can't shed blood here in the sacred city, but I can.
He laid the point of his sword between Daenerys' breasts and slid it downwards over the curve of her belly.
I want what I came for, he told her. I want the crown he promised me. He bought you, but he never paid for you. Tell him I want what I bargained for, or I'm taking you back, you and the eggs both. He can keep his bloody foal. I'll cut the bastard out and leave it for him.
The sword point pushed through her silks and pricked at her navel. Viserys was weeping, she saw, weeping and laughing both at the same time, this man who had once been her brother. Distantly, as from far away, Dany heard her handmaid Jiqui sobbing in fear, pleading that she dared not translate, that the Khal would bind her and drag her behind his horses all the way up the Mother of Mountains. She put her arm around the girl. Don't be afraid, she said. I shall tell him. She did not know if she had enough words. Yet when she was done, Khal Drogo spoke a few brusque sentences in Dothraki, and she knew he understood. The son of her life stepped down from the high bench.
What did he say?
The man who had been her brother asked, flinching. It had grown so silent in the hall that she could hear the bells in Khal Drogo's hair chiming softly with each step he took. His blood riders followed him, like three copper shadows. Daenerys had gone cold all over. He says, you shall have a splendid golden crown that men shall tremble to behold. Viserys smiled and lowered his sword. That was the saddest thing, the thing that tore at her afterward, the way he smiled.
That was all I wanted, he said. What was promised?
When the son of her life reached her, Dany slid an arm around his waist. The Khal said a word, and his blood riders leapt forward. Kotho seized the man, who had been her brother, by the arms. Hagar shattered his wrist with a single sharp twist of his huge hands. Kahalo pulled the sword from his limp fingers. Even now, Viserys did not understand.
No, he shouted, you cannot touch me. I am the dragon, and I will be crowned.
Khal Drogo unfastened his belt. The medallions were pure gold, massive and ornate, each one as large as a man's hand. He shouted a command. Cook slaves pulled a heavy iron stew pot from the fire pit, dumped the stew onto the ground, and returned the pot to the flames. Drogo tossed in the belt and watched without expression as the medallions turned red and began to lose their shape. She could see fires dancing in the onyx of his eyes. A slave handed him a pair of thick horsehair mittens, and he pulled them on, never so much as looking at the man. Viserys began to scream, the high, wordless scream of the coward facing death. He kicked and twisted, whimpered like a dog, and wept like a child, but the Dothraki held him tight between them. Sir Jorah had made his way to Dany's side. He put a hand on her shoulder.
Turn away, my princess, I beg you.
No. She folded her arms across the swell of her belly protectively. At the last, Viserys looked at her.
Sister, please, Dany, tell them, make them, sweet sister.
When the gold was half melted and starting to run, Drogo reached into the flames, snatched out the pot.
"Crown!" he roared. "Here, a crown for Card King!"
And upended the pot over the head of the man who had been her brother. The sound Viserys Targaryen made when that hideous iron helmet covered his face was like nothing human. His feet hammered a frantic beat against the dirt floor, slowed, stopped. Thick globs of molten gold dripped down onto his chest, setting the scarlet silk to smouldering. Yet no drop of blood was spilled. He was no dragon, Danny thought, curiously calm. Fire cannot kill a dragon.
Meanwhile, back on the wall. "Hey, wait a minute," some of you may be saying about now. "Wait a minute, wait a minute. Where's Dany and the dragons? Where's Tyrion? We hardly saw Jon Snow. That can't be all of it." Well, no, there's more to come. Another book as big as this one. I did not forget to write about the other characters. Far from it. I wrote lots about them. Pages and pages and pages. Chapters and more chapters. I was still writing when it dawned on me that the book had become too big to publish in a single volume, and I wasn't close to finished yet. To tell all of the story that I wanted to tell, I was going to have to cut the book in two. The simplest way to do that would have been to take what I had, chop it in half around the middle, and end with "to be continued." The more I thought about that, however, the more I felt that the readers would be better served by a book that told all the story for half the characters rather than half the story for all the characters. So that's the route I chose to take. Tyrion, Jon, Dany, Stannis, and Melisandre, Davos Seaworth, and all the rest of the characters you love or love to hate will be along next year, I devoutly hope, in A Dance with Dragons, which will be focused on events along the Wall and across the sea, just as the present book focused on King's Landing. George R. R. Martin, June 2005.
Samwell.
"White tree," Sam thought. "Please, let this be White Tree."
He remembered White Tree. White Tree was on the maps he'd drawn on their way north. If this village was White Tree, he knew where they were.
"Please, it has to be."
He wanted that so badly that he forgot his feet for a little bit. He forgot the ache in his calves and his lower back and the stiff frozen fingers he could scarcely feel. He even forgot about Lord Mormont and Craster, and the Whites, and the others.
"White Tree,"
Sam prayed, to any god that might be listening. All wildling villages look much alike, though. A huge weirwood grew in the centre of this one, but a white tree did not mean White Tree necessarily. Hadn't the weirwood at White Tree been bigger than this one? Maybe he was remembering it wrong. The face carved in the bone-pale trunk was long and sad. Red tears of dried sap leaked from its eyes.
"Was that how it looked when we came north?"
Sam couldn't recall. Around the tree stood a handful of one-room hovels with sod roofs, a long hall built of logs and grown over with moss, a stone well, a sheepfold, but no sheep, nor any people. The wildlings had gone to join Mance Rayder in the Frostfangs, taking all they owned except their houses. Sam was thankful for that. Night was coming on, and it would be good to sleep beneath a roof for once. He was so tired, it seemed as though he had been walking half his life. His boots were falling to pieces, and all the blisters on his feet had burst and turned to callus. But now he had new blisters under the callus, and his toes were getting frostbitten. But it was either walk or die, Sam knew. Gilly was still weak from childbirth and carrying the babe besides. She needed the horse more than he did.
The second horse had died on them 3 days out from Craster's Keep. It was a wonder she lasted that long, poor half-starved thing. Sam's weight had probably done for her. They might have tried riding double, but he was afraid the same thing would happen again. It's better that I walk. Sam left Gilly in the long hall to make a fire while he poked his head into the hovels. She was better at making fires. He could never seem to get the kindling to catch, and the last time he'd tried to strike a spark, or flint and steel, he managed to cut himself on his knife. Gilly bound up the gash for him, but his hand was stiff and sore, even clumsier than it had been before. He knew he should wash the wound and change the binding, but he was afraid to look at it. Besides, it was so cold that he hated taking off his gloves. Sam did not know what he hoped to find in the empty houses. Maybe the wildlings had left some food behind. He had to take a look. John had searched the huts at White Tree on their way north. Inside one hovel, Sam heard a rustling of rats from a dark corner, but otherwise there was nothing in any of them but old straw, old smells, and some ashes beneath the smoke hole. He turned back to the weirwood and studied the carved face a moment.
"It is not the face we saw," he admitted to himself. "The tree's not half as big as the one at White Tree."
The red eyes wept blood, and he didn't remember that either. Clumsily, Sam sank to his knees.
"All gods, hear my prayer. The seven were my father's gods, but I said my words to you when I joined the watch. Help us now. I fear we might be lost. We're hungry, too, and so cold. I don't know what gods I believe in now, but please, if you're there, help us. Gilly has a little son."
That was all he could think to say. The dusk was deepening, the leaves of the weirwood rustling softly, waving like a thousand blood-red hands. Whether John's guards had heard him or not, he could not say. By the time he returned to the long hall, Gilly had the fire going. She sat close to it with her furs opened, the babe at her breast.
"He's as hungry as we are," Sam thought.
The old women had smuggled out food for them from Craster's, but they had eaten most of it by now. Sam had been a hopeless hunter, even at Horn Hill, where game was plentiful, and he had hounds and huntsmen to help him. Here, in this endless, empty forest, the chances of him catching anything were remote. His efforts at fishing the lakes and half-frozen streams had been dismal failures as well.
"How much longer, Sam?"
Gilly asked.
"Is it far still?" "Not so far, not so far as it was."
Sam shrugged out of his pack, eased himself awkwardly to the floor, and tried to cross his legs. His back ached so abominably from the walking that he would have liked to lean up against one of the carved wooden pillars that supported the roof, but the fire was in the centre of the hall beneath the smoke hole, and he craved warmth even more than comfort.
"Another few days should see us there."
Sam had his maps, but if this wasn't White Tree, then they weren't going to be much use.
"We went too far east to get around that lake," he fretted, "and maybe too far west when I tried to double back."
He was coming to hate lakes and rivers. Up here there was never a ferry or bridge, which meant walking all the way around the lakes and searching for places to ford the rivers. It was easier to follow a game trail than to struggle through the brush, easier to circle a ridge instead of climbing it.
"If Bannon or Daywin were with us, we'd be at Castle Black by now, warming our feet in the common room."
Bannon was dead, though, and Daywin gone with Gren and Dolorous Ed and the others.
"The wall is 300 miles long and 700 feet high,"
Sam reminded himself. If they kept going south, they had to find it, sooner or later. And he was certain that they had been going south. By day he took directions from the sun, and on clear nights they could follow the ice dragon's tail, even though they hadn't travelled much by night since the second horse had died. Even when the moon was full, It was too dark beneath the trees, and it would have been so easy for Sam or the last Garen to break a leg.
"We have to be well south by now. We have to be."
What he wasn't so certain of was how far east or west they might have strayed. They would reach the wall, yes, in a day or a fortnight. It couldn't be farther than that, surely.
Surely. But where?
It was the gate at Castle Black they needed to find. The only way through the wall for 100 leagues.
"Is the wall as big as Craster used to say?"
Gilly asked.
"Bigger," Sam tried to sound cheerful. "So big you can't even see the castles hidden behind it. But they're there, you'll see. The wall is all ice, but the castles are stone and wood. There are tall towers and deep vaults and a huge lung hole with a great fire burning in the hearth day and night. It's so hot in there, Gilly, you'd hardly believe it. Could I stand by the fire, me and the boy? Not for a long time, just till we get good and warm." "You can stand by the fire as long as you like. You'll have food and drink, too. Hot mulled wine and a bowl of venison stewed with onions, and Hob's bread right out of the oven, so hot you'll burn your fingers."
Sam peeled off a glove to wriggle his own fingers near the flames, and soon regretted it. They had been numb with cold, but as feeling returned, they hurt so much he almost cried.
"Sometimes one of the brothers will sing," he said, to take his mind off the pain. "Darien sang best, but they sent him to Eastwatch. There's still Halder, though, and Toad. His real name is Tudder, but he looks like a toad, so we call him that. He likes to sing, but he has an awful voice."
"Do you sing?" Gilly rearranged her furs as she moved the babe from one breast to the other. Sam blushed.
I know some songs. When I was little, I liked to sing. I danced too, but my Lord Father never liked me to. He said if I wanted to prance about, I should do it in the yard with a sword in me hand.
Could you sing some Southron song for the babe?
If you like,
Sam thought for a moment.
There's a song our Septon used to sing to me and my sisters when we were little and it was time for us to go to sleep. The Song of the Seven, it's called.
He cleared his throat and softly sang.
The father's face is stern and strong. He sits and judges right from wrong. He weighs our lives the short and long and loves the little children. The mother gives the gift of life and watches over every wife. Her gentle smile ends all strife and she loves her little children. The warrior stands before the foe, protecting us where'er we go. With sword and shield and spear and bow, he guards the little children. The crone is very wise and old, and sees our fates as they unfold. She lifts her lamp of shining gold to lead the little children. The smith, he labours day and night to put the world of men to right. With hammer, plough, and fire bright, he builds for little children. The maiden dances through the sky. She lives in every lover's sigh. Her smiles teach the birds to fly and give dreams to little children. The seven gods who made us all are listening if we should call. So close your eyes, you shall not fall. They see you, little children. So close your eyes, you shall not fall. They see you, little children.
Sam remembered the last time he'd sung the song with his mother, to lull baby Dickon to sleep. His father had heard their voices and come barging in angry.
"I will have no more of that,"
Lord Randall told his wife harshly. "You ruin one boy with those soft Septon songs. Do you mean to do the same to this babe?" Then he looked at Sam and said, "Go, sing to your sisters, if you must sing. I don't want you near my son." Gilly's babe had gone to sleep. He was such a tiny thing, and so quiet that Sam feared for him. He didn't even have a name.
He had asked Gilly about that, but she said it was bad luck to name a child before he was two. So many of them died. She tucked her nipple back inside her furs.
That was pretty, Sam. You sing good. You should hear Darian. His voice is sweet as mead. We drank the sweetest mead the day Craster made me a wife. It was summer then, and not so cold.
Gilly gave him a puzzled look.
Did you only sing of six gods? Craster always told us you Southerns had seven. Seven, he agreed, but no one sings of the stranger.
The stranger's face was the face of death. Even talking of him made Sam uncomfortable.
We should eat something, a bite or two.
Nothing was left but a few black sausages, as hard as wood. Sam sawed off a few thin slices for each of them. The effort made his wrist ache, but he was hungry enough to persist. If you chewed the slices long enough, they softened up and tasted good. Craster's wives seasoned them with garlic. After they had finished, Sam begged her pardon and went out to relieve himself and look after the horse. A biting wind was blowing from the north, and the leaves and the trees rattled at him as he passed. He had to break the thin scum of ice on top of the stream so the horse could get a drink.
I had better bring her inside.
He did not want to wake up at break of day to find that their horse had frozen to death during the night.
Gilly would keep going even if that happened.
The girl was very brave, not like him. He wished she knew what he was going to do with her back at Castle Black. She kept saying how she'd be his wife if he wanted. But Black Brothers didn't keep wives. Besides, he was a Tarly of Horn Hill. He could never wed a wildling.
I'll have to think of something, so long as we reach the wall alive. The rest doesn't matter. It doesn't matter one little bit.
Leading the horse to the long hall was simple enough. Getting her through the door was not. But Sam persisted. Gilly was already dozing by the time he got the garron inside. He hobbled the horse in a corner, fed some fresh wood to the fire, took off his heavy cloak, and wriggled down under the furs beside the wilding woman. His cloak was big enough to cover all three of them and keep in the warmth of their bodies. Gilly smelled of milk and garlic and musty old fur, but he was used to that by now. They were good smells, so far as Sam was concerned. He liked sleeping next to her. It made him remember times long past when he had shared a huge bed at Horn Hill with two of his sisters. That had ended when Lord Randall decided it was making him soft as a girl.
Sleeping alone in my own coal cell never made me any harder or braver, though.
He wondered what his father would say if he could see him now.
I killed one of the others, my lord, he imagined saying. I stabbed him with an obsidian dagger, and my sworn brothers call me Sam the Slayer now.
But even in his fancies, Lord Randall only scowled, disbelieving. His dreams were strange that night. He was back at Horn Hill, at the castle, but his father was not there. It was Sam's castle now. Jon Snow was with him, Lord Mormont too, the old bear, and Gren, and Dolorous Ed, and Pip, and Toad, and all his other brothers from the Watch. But they wore bright colours instead of black. Sam sat at the high table and feasted them all, cutting thick slices off a roast with his father's great sword Heartsbane. There were sweet cakes to eat and honeyed wine to drink. There was singing and dancing, and everyone was warm. When the feast was done, he went up to sleep, not to the Lord's bedchamber where his mother and father lived, but to the room he had once shared with his sisters. Only instead of his sisters, it was Gilly waiting in the huge, soft bed, wearing nothing but a big shaggy fur, milk leaking from her breasts. He woke suddenly, in cold and dread. The fire had burned down to smouldering red embers. The air itself seemed frozen. It was so cold. In the corner, the garron was whinnying and kicking the logs with her hind legs. Gilly sat beside the fire, hugging her babe. Sam sat up, groggy, his breath puffing pale from his open mouth. The long hall was dark with shadows, black and blacker. The hair on his arms was standing up.
"It's nothing," he told himself. "I'm cold, that's all."
Then by the door, one of the shadows moved, a big one.
"This is still a dream," Sam prayed. "Oh, make it that I'm still asleep. Make it a nightmare. He's dead. He's dead. I saw him die."
"He's come for the babe," Gilly wept. "He smells him. A babe fresh born stinks of life. He's come for the life."
The huge dark shape stooped under the lintel, into the hall, and shambled toward them. In the dim light of the fire, the shadow became Small Paul.
"Go away," Sam croaked. "We don't want you here."
Paul's hands were coal. His face was milk. His eyes shone a bitter blue. Hoarfrost whitened his beard, and on one shoulder hunched a raven, pecking at his cheek, eating the dead white flesh. Sam's bladder let go, and he felt the warmth running down his legs.
"Kelly, calm the horse and lead her out. You do that."
"You," she started, "I have the knife, the dragonglass dagger."
He fumbled it out as he got to his feet. He'd given the first knife to Gren, but thankfully he remembered to take Lord Mormont's dagger before fleeing Craster's keep. He clutched it tight, moving away from the fire, away from Gilly and the babe.
"Paul,"
he meant to sound brave, but it came out in a squeak.
"Small Paul, do you know me? I'm Sam, Fat Sam, Sam the Scared. You saved me in the woods. You carried me when I couldn't walk another step. No one else could have done that, but you did."
Sam backed away, knife in hand, snivelling.
"I am such a coward. Don't hurt us, Paul, please. Why would you want to hurt us?"
Gilly scrabbled backward across the hard dirt floor. The white turned his head to look at her, but Sam shouted, "No!" and he turned back. The raven on his shoulder ripped a strip of flesh from his pale, ruined cheek. Sam held the dagger before him, breathing like a blacksmith's bellows. Across the long hall, Gilly had reached the garren.
"God, give me courage," Sam prayed. "For once, give me a little courage, just long enough for her to get away."
Small Paul moved toward him. Sam backed off until he came up against a rough log wall. He clutched the dagger with both hands to hold it steady. The white did not seem to fear the dragonglass. Perhaps he did not know what it was. He moved slowly, but Small Paul had never been quick, even when he'd been alive. Behind him, Gilly murmured to calm the garren and tried to urge it toward the door, but the horse must have caught a whiff of the white's queer, cold scent. Suddenly she balked, rearing, her hooves lashing at the frosty air. Paul swung toward the sound and seemed to lose all interest in Sam. There was no time to think or pray or be afraid. Sam Tarwell threw himself forward and plunged the dagger down into Small Paul's back. Half-turned, the white never saw him coming. The raven gave a shriek and took to the air.
"You're dead," Sam screamed as he stabbed. "You're dead, you're dead."
He stabbed and screamed again and again, tearing huge rents in Paul's heavy black cloak. Shards of dragonglass flew everywhere as the blade shattered on the iron mail beneath the wall. Sam's wail made a white mist in the black air. He dropped the useless hilt and took a hasty step backwards as Small Paul twisted around. Before he could get out his other knife, the steel knife that every brother carried, the white's black hands locked beneath his chins. Paul's fingers were so cold they seemed to burn. They burrowed deep into the soft flesh of Sam's throat.
"Run, Kelly, run!"
He wanted to scream, but when he opened his mouth, only a choking sound emerged. His fumbling fingers finally found the dagger,
but when he slammed it up into the white's belly, the point skidded off the iron links, and the blade went spinning from Sam's hand. Small Paul's fingers tightened inexorably and began to twist.
"He's gonna rip my head off," Sam thought in despair.
His throat felt frozen, his lungs on fire. He punched and pulled at the white's wrists to no avail. He kicked Paul between the legs uselessly. The world shrank to two blue stars, a terrible crushing pain, and a cold so fierce that his tears froze over his eyes. Sam squirmed and pulled, desperate, and then he lurched forward. Small Paul was big and powerful, but Sam still outweighed him, and the whites were clumsy. He had seen that on the fist. The sudden shift sent Paul staggering back a step, and the living man and the dead one went crashing down together. The impact knocked one hand from Sam's throat, and he was able to suck in a quick breath of air before the icy black fingers returned. The taste of blood filled his mouth. He twisted his neck around, looking for his knife, and saw a dull orange glow.
The fire!
Only ember and ashes remained, but still, he could not breathe or think. Sam wrenched himself sideways, pulling Paul with him. His arms flailed against the dirt floor, groping, reaching, scattering the ashes, until at last they found something hot, a chunk of charred wood, smouldering red and orange within the black. His fingers closed around it, and he smashed it into Paul's mouth, so hard he felt teeth shatter. Yet even so, the white's grip did not loosen. Sam's last thoughts before the mother who had loved him and the father he had failed. The long hall was spinning around him when he saw the wisp of smoke rising from between Paul's broken teeth. Then the dead man's face burst into flame, and the hands were gone. Sam sucked in air and rolled feebly away. The white was burning, hoarfrost dripping from his beard as the flesh beneath blackened. Sam heard the raven shriek, but Paul himself made no sound. When his mouth opened, only flames came out, and his eyes.
"It's gone. The blue glow is gone."
He crept to the door. The air was so cold that it hurt to breathe, but such a fine, sweet hurt. He ducked from the long hall.
"Gilly!" he called. "Gilly! I killed her! Gil—"
She stood with her back against the weirwood, the boy in her arms. The whites were all around her. There were a dozen of them, a score, more. Some had been wildlings once and still wore skins and hides, but more had been his brothers. Sam saw Lark the Sisterman, Softfoot, Riles. The wen on Chet's neck was black, his boils covered with a thin film of ice. And that one looked like Hake, though it was hard to know for certain, with half his head missing. They had torn the poor Garen apart and were pulling out her entrails with dripping red hands. Pale steam rose from her belly. Sam made a whimpering sound.
"It's not fair."
"Fair!"
The raven landed on his shoulder.
"Fair! Far! Fear!"
It flapped its wings and screamed along with Gilly. The whites were almost on her. He heard the dark red leaves of the weirwood rustling, whispering to one another in a tongue he did not know. The starlight itself seemed to stir, and all around them the trees groaned and creaked. Sam Tarley turned the colour of curdled milk, and his eyes went wide as plates.
Ravens!
They were in the weirwoods, hundreds of them, thousands, perched on the bone-white branches, peering between the leaves. He saw their beaks open as they screamed, saw them spread their black wings. Shrieking, flapping, they descended on the whites in angry clouds. They swarmed around Chet's face and pecked at his blue eyes. They covered the sister man like flies. They plucked gobbets from inside Hake's shattered head. There were so many that when Sam looked up, he could not see the moon.
"Go!"
said the bird on his shoulder.
Go! Go! Go!
Sam ran, puffs of frost exploding from his mouth. All around him, the whites flailed at the black wings and sharp beaks that assailed them, falling in an eerie silence with never a grunt nor cry. But the ravens ignored Sam. He took Gilly by the hand and pulled her away from the weirwood.
We have to go.
But where?
Gilly hurried after him, holding her baby.
They killed our horse. How will we...
Brother!
The shout cut through the night, through the shrieks of 1,000 ravens. Beneath the trees, a man, muffled head to heels, in mottled blacks and greys, sat astride an elk.
Here!
The rider called. A hood shadowed his face.
He's wearing blacks.
Sam urged Gilly toward him. The elk was huge, a great elk, 10 feet tall at the shoulders, with a rack of antlers near as wide. The creature sank to his knees to let them mount.
Here,
the rider said, reaching down with a gloved hand to pull Gilly up behind him. Then it was Sam's turn.
My thanks, he puffed.
Only when he grasped the offered hand did he realize that the rider wore no glove. His hand was black and cold, with fingers hard as stone. Arya. When they reached the top of the ridge and saw the river, Sandor Clegane reined up hard and cursed. The rain was falling from a black iron sky, pricking the green and brown torrent with 10,000 swords.
It must be a mile across, Arya thought.
The tops of 50 trees poked up out of the swirling waters, their limbs clutching for the sky like the arms of drowning men. Thick mats of sudden leaves choked the shoreline, and farther out in the channel she glimpsed something pale and swollen, a deer, or perhaps a dead horse, moving swiftly downstream. There was a sound, too, a low rumble at the edge of hearing, like the sound a dog makes just before he growls. Arya squirmed in the saddle and felt the links of the hound's mail digging into her back. His arms encircled her. On the left, the burned arm, he'd donned a steel vambrace for protection. But she'd seen him change the dressings, and the flesh beneath was still raw and seeping. If the burns pained him, though, Sandor Clegane gave no hint of it.
Is this the Blackwater Rush?
They had ridden so far in rain and darkness, through trackless woods and nameless villages, that Arya had lost all sense of where they were.
It's a river we need to cross. That's all you need to know.
Clegane would answer her from time to time, but he had warned her not to talk back. He had given her a lot of warnings that first day.
The next time you hit me, I'll tie your hands behind your back, he said. The next time you try and run off, I'll bind your feet together. Scream or shout or bite me again and I'll gag you. We can ride double, or I can throw you across the back of my horse, trussed up like a sow for slaughter. Your choice.
She had chosen to ride, but the first time they made camp, she'd waited until she thought he was asleep and found a big, jagged rock to smash his ugly head in.
Quiet as a shadow, she told herself as she crept toward him, but that wasn't quiet enough.
The hound hadn't been asleep after all, or maybe he'd woken. Whichever way it was, his eyes opened, his mouth twitched, and he took the rock away from her as if she were a baby. The best she could do was kick him.
I'll give you that one,
he said when he flung the rock into the bushes.
But if you're stupid enough to try again, I'll hurt you.
Why don't you just kill me like you did Micah?
Arya had screamed at him. She was still defiant then, more angry than scared. He answered by grabbing the front of her tunic and yanking her within an inch of his burned face.
The next time you say that name, I'll beat you so bad you'll wish I'd killed you.
After that, he rolled her in his horse blanket every night
when he went to sleep, and tied ropes around her top and bottom, so she was bound up as tight as a babe in swaddling clothes.
"It has to be the Blackwater,"
Arya decided, as she watched the rain lash the river. The hound was Joffrey's dog. He was taking her back to the Red Keep to hand to Joffrey and the Queen. She wished that the sun would come out so she could tell which way they were going. The more she looked at the moss on the trees, the more confused she got.
The Blackwater wasn't so wide at King's Landing, but that was before the rains.
"The fords will all be gone," Sandor Clegane said, "and I wouldn't care to try and swim over neither."
"There's no way across," she thought. "Lord Beric will catch us for sure."
Clegane had pushed his big black stallion hard, doubling back thrice to throw off pursuit, once even riding half a mile up the centre of a swollen stream. But Arya still expected to see the outlaws every time she looked back. She had tried to help them by scratching her name on the trunks of trees when she went in the bushes to make water, but the fourth time she did it, he caught her, and that was the end of that.
"It doesn't matter," Arya told herself. "Thoris will find me in his flames."
Only he hadn't. Not yet, anyway. And once they crossed the river...
"Harroway Town shouldn't be far," the hound said, "where Lord Root stables old King Andahar's two-headed water horse. Maybe we'll ride across."
Arya had never heard of old King Andahar. She'd never seen a horse with two heads either, especially not one who could run on water. But she knew better than to ask. She held her tongue and sat stiff as the hound turned the stallion's head and trotted along the ridgeline following the river downstream. At least the rain was at their backs this way. She'd had enough of it stinging her eyes, half blind, and washing down her cheeks like she was crying.
"Wolves never cry," she reminded herself again.
It could not have been much past noon, but the sky was dark as dusk. They had not seen the sun in more days than she could count. Arya was soaked to the bone, saddle sore, sniffling and aching. She had a fever, too, and sometimes shivered uncontrollably. But when she told the hound that she was sick, he only snarled at her.
"Wipe your nose and shut your mouth," he told her.
Half the time, he slept in the saddle now, trusting his stallion to follow whatever rutted farm track or game trail they were on. The horse was a heavy courser, almost as big as a destrier, but much faster.
"Stranger," the hound called him.
Arya had tried to steal him once, when Clegane was taking a piss against a tree, thinking she could ride off before he could catch her. Stranger had almost bitten her face off. He was gentle as an old gelding with his master, but otherwise he had a temper as black as he was. She had never known a horse so quick to bite or kick. They rode beside the river for hours, splashing across two muddy vassal streams before they reached the place that Sandor Clegane had spoken of.
"Lord Harroway's town," he said,
and then when he saw it,
"Seven Hells."
The town was drowned and desolate. The rising waters had overflowed the river banks. All that remained of Harroway Town was the upper story of a daub and wattle inn, the seven-sided dome of a sunken sept, two-thirds of a stone round tower, some mouldy thatch roofs, and a forest of chimneys. But there was smoke coming from the tower, Arya saw, and below one arched window a wide, flat-bottomed boat was chained up tight. The boat had a dozen oarlocks and a pair of great carved wooden horses' heads mounted fore and aft.
The two-headed horse, she realized.
There was a wooden house with a sod roof right in the middle of the deck, and when the hound cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted, two men came spilling out. A third appeared in the window of the round tower, clutching a loaded crossbow.
"What do you want?"
he shouted across the swirling brown waters.
"Take us over,"
the hound shouted back. The men in the boat conferred with one another. One of them, a grizzled grey-haired man with thick arms and a bent back, stepped to the rail.